Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, August 18th, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Trump administration officially announces plans to end Forest Service roadless rule. Hazmat teams enter Spokane fire zones. And Moscow City Council approves $150 million fiscal year 2027 budget after discussion of funding for public safety versus the arts. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Hazmat teams from the Environmental Protection Agency have entered the fire zones in and near Spokane and begun going through fire-damaged homes. EPA Region 10 Incident Commander Brooks Stanfield told the spokesman review the teams are looking for pesticides, herbicides, pool chemicals, degreasers, cleaners, compressed gas cylinders, and lithium batteries. Stanfield said the teams will bag identified materials, load them into trucks, and the trucks will take them to a staging area in Colbert, where the waste will be consolidated and shipped to a disposal or treatment facility. Stanfield said the project will take less than 60 days, and the presence of those who have lived at the damaged homes may impede their operations. He said property owners can track hazmat teams on the Environmental Protection Agency's website. Stanfield said the goal is to get the worst of the worst hazards. He said, "We know that even after the household hazardous materials are removed, there are still going to be likely health risks present on the property. We see that with ash containing heavy metals and asbestos fibers and other potential contaminants. So after EPA has completed the household hazardous material removal, there will still be ash. There will still be debris on the property. What our work does is it helps set up that next phase to be done in a safer and more quick fashion." Meanwhile, many firefighters who fought the blazes did not have respiratory protection and were exposed to toxins. Spokane Fire Department spokesperson Justin DeReuter said firefighters were dispatched to fight brush fires August 1st and did not have time to go back to their stations to obtain proper breathing equipment for fighting the wildland-urban interface fires. Firefighters and other first responders sat in a white medical tent at the Spokane County Fairgrounds in recent days, taking treatments of glutathione through nebulizers and IVs. Glutathione is a naturally occurring antioxidant that human organs produce that helps people detoxify. The Volunteer Fire Foundation and the Integrative Health Action Network provided the glutathione treatments for free. The spokesman review reports the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has not approved glutathione as a detoxifying agent, because so far there has not been large randomized controlled studies to confirm IV infusions of glutathione flushes toxins from the body. Meanwhile, WSU entomology collection manager Joel Gardner says the groups of black biting beetles firefighters are finding in the Spokane fire zones are likely black fire beetles, which bore into wood to lay their eggs. Gardner says, true to their name, the black fire beetles prefer to lay their eggs in fire-scorched landscapes. He said, they come pretty fast after a fire. The firefighters are still going to be on the scene fighting the fires when the beetles start coming in, so that's why they can be a nuisance to the firefighters. They're some of the first insects that move back into a burned area. The Trump administration announced today it's going ahead with plans to end the 25-year-old roadless rule, which blocks logging and mining development on 30% of national forest land nationwide before the land can be considered for inclusion in the nation's wilderness system. Trump's agriculture secretary is claiming the roadless rule is a failure because it blocks loggers from improving forest health. But the Sierra Club Forest Campaign Manager, Alex Craven, said removing the rule will not allow more work to reduce wildfire threats. Craven said more roads lead to more fires, and that the roadless rule never prevented the Forest Service from doing work to reduce wildfires in the first place. The public has until Monday, September 21st, to comment on the rescission, which would impact 59 million acres of roadless Forest Service land nationwide. According to the Associated Press, Wild Earth Guardians attorney Chris Krupp said, "Americans across the political spectrum have made it crystal clear that they don't want political appointees removing protections from public lands. It would be a gross misreading of public sentiment to take the roadless rule away from Americans and our wildlife, and politicians do so at their jeopardy." President Bill Clinton signed the roadless rule during the last days of his presidency in 2001. During the first Trump administration, Trump officials lifted restrictions on road building in Alaska's Tongass National Forest, which has the largest expanse of roadless lands in the National Forest System. The Biden administration reversed that decision. Alaska Wilderness League Government Affairs Manager Emma Powell said the Tongass is a global treasure that's home to salmon and other abundant wildlife. Powell said cultures and livelihoods are connected to the forest. She said, from fisheries to tourism and outdoor recreation, these landscapes also support thousands of jobs and generate billions in economic activity each year. Trump officials announced their intent to get rid of the roadless rule at the Western Governors Association meeting in New Mexico last year. Now their decision has been published in the Federal Register.
Idahoans strongly support protecting public lands regardless of their political views, according to a new poll. The Western Voter Views of Public Lands Issues survey by the Nature Conservancy finds that 83% of Idahoans oppose selling public lands to private interests. That's higher than the 80% opposed across the U.S. West. Bass Hargrove with the Nature Conservancy's Idaho chapter says the results make it clear that the Gem State cherishes its public lands.
Places like the Sawtooths or the Selkirks that are on public lands are where we take our children and grandchildren hunting, fishing, and camping. We go there with our friends, and selling them off means fewer opportunities for future generations to get outdoors.
The poll also shows 75% of Idahoans oppose staffing and funding cuts to federal land management, and fewer than a third support transferring federal land management to the states. Pollsters interviewed more than 2,000 people from Idaho and 11 other Western states, including Montana, Wyoming, and Washington. The interviews were conducted between January 17th and February 1st by Republican polling firm New Bridge West and Democratic polling firm FM3 Research. Miranda Everett with FM3 Research is used to seeing opposition to this issue as part of her work, but the intensity of it across political lines took her by surprise.
The opposition was just really overwhelming in every place we asked about it, from 70% in Alaska opposed to it to 88% in Montana opposed to it, across states with different partisan breakdowns.
Everett adds the poll clearly shows people understand transferring federal public land management to the states would be costly. Hargrove agrees, noting he wants those in power to pay attention to these results.
I hope that policymakers understand clearly how much the public cares about public lands, and that when they make decisions, they make them in the public's interest.
The Trump administration is proposing a 34% cut for the Federal Bureau of Land Management's budget in fiscal year 2027, along with a 27% reduction in staff. I'm Laura Hatch, Northern Rockies News Service.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Stop Northwest Gas Expansion, an alliance committed to exposing the truth about the harms to our health and safety caused by toxic and explosive natural gas, and preventing these harms by stopping the expansion of gas supply, including increases in gas pipeline pressure.
KRFP is also sponsored by Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. a conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
The Moscow City Council last night passed its fiscal year 2027 budget, just shy of $150 million, which includes the maximum 3% tax levy increase allowed by state law. During a public hearing on the budget, 12 people spoke against it, saying the $796,000 budgeted for the East City Park stage and various art projects would hurt the safety of the city. Here's former Moscow City Council candidate John Slagboom.
Inadequate funding to properly maintain the city streets. The same budget cuts the roadway improvement program by 55%, from $3 million to around $1.3 million. People are paying twice for streets. They pay their property taxes, and then they pay hospital bills and repair bills that the potholes create.
Slagboom ran for city council last year on a platform of small government, equal representation, fiscal responsibility, and affordable housing. In a column in the Idaho Statesman after the election, Slagboom said he was smeared in the press, quote, because the broad appeal of my message also resonated with many independents and conservatives, and because members of Doug Wilson's Christ Church tend towards conservatism. I was labeled as a kirker and accused of all sorts of imaginary offenses. Slagboom received a $1,000 campaign contribution from Christ Church elder Andrew Krapachets of Moscow, who owns the 235-acre Eddington Addition parcel south of the city, and who was one of three Christ Church-connected purchasers who purchased the three-story David's building at the corner of 3rd and South Main Streets in Moscow, which is currently under development. Besides Krapachets, the other partners in the purchase are Pastor Doug Wilson's son, Nate Wilson, and Aaron Wrench, the brother of Christ Church Deacon Gabriel Wrench, who ran for Latah County Commission as a Republican in 2020. Slagboom's other campaign contributions, over $500, were from local film director Graham Wilson and Jeff Mao, both of Moscow, who each gave $1,000. Since his election, Slagboom has focused his criticism of the city council on their support for the East City Park stage. Here's Slagboom during last night's city budget public hearing, followed by another opponent of the budget, Rachel Tavella.
The East City Park stage is not on the priority list or on the capital improvement list or in the mayor's budget address, yet this budget funds it at almost $800,000. That one stage equals 58.7% of the entire road program. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm in favor of having a community stage. What I'm not in favor of is wasteful and flagrant government spending. As I'm aware, a licensed, bonded, and insured contractor offered to donate and install all the stage's concrete to engineering specifications at no cost to the city. I've heard that offer was never answered, and it never reached this council. The city's own 249-page bid package has no way to accept donated work. Volunteers built the last stage and repaired it after 2009 arson, and if we have to build a new stage, which we do, I volunteer my own time to coordinate the volunteers and sponsors who will get it built.
Now, we've heard about the minus three police positions, you know, lack of available funding, this and that, we're not going to do it. You guys have approved 1% for art every year. That's a police officer and a half, because you are prioritizing aesthetics over public safety. Like, I understand that overtime is cheap in the short run, but the God forbid a tired, cranky cop makes a bad call. That's not what we need. We need less murals, which could be donated, and we need police. You know, all of us in Moscow can be assured, you know, we love no kings, right? And yet you guys sit here like a giant board of kings, not acknowledging what we say or caring at all. You're like Prince John with the property taxes. The stage, that's a boob job when you need to pay a mortgage and the roof is falling in. So I would encourage you to look and see what has to be done now, what is frivolous, and what is just aesthetics and entertainment and what can be donated, because we of the city of Moscow would love to do that if you would let us. Thank you.
That was Rachel Tavella, preceded by John Slagboom. New St. Andrews College student and Marine veteran Joshua David Krushevich, who has lived in Moscow for about a year, also took aim at the East City Park stage.
Fire department student resident program being underfunded doesn't sound very reassuring to me, considering that Washington and Oregon this summer was burning a lot. And we all had the smoke in our lungs and probably in our houses too, up until about a couple of days ago when that rain from God came down and washed all of the smoke away. So Idaho didn't burn, but Washington and Oregon did, and the Canadians as well, but one might say that that was deserved. So per the budget plan challenges, Moscow is already hurting for medical and ER personnel. Now, the reason stated was that there was not enough money to fund these programs and to fill those positions at the city level. And so as others have noted, building a stage that costs $796,000, which, Mayor Lewis, you did specify that this is an estimate for the city budget. And so there's a bid that will come down, which will finalize the price number. I actually don't really care that there's not a set number. In my opinion, anything is too much when you have essential medical and fire programs which aren't being funded. Not only that, but property tax is being raised by the maximum 3%.
Two of the people who spoke in favor of the proposed budget were Victoria Sievert and David Pimentel. Pimentel lives adjacent to East City Park.
While it seems to be human nature to blame a handy target for a shrinking pocketbook, we can't expect grocers to sell at a loss or doctors to work free or cities to do it all on a tight budget, which the minimal allowed 3% increase won't even keep up with inflation. And city services are not just patching streets and flushing toilets if it's a city worth calling home. A city is function and community. A budget is more than divvying up dollars. Per usual, for my at least 10th time, I attended the annual budget workshop, and I continue to be impressed with the high caliber work and dedication of city employees at all levels, despite decreasing funding and increasing costs. Many line items found ways to cut back, defer, or sustain at present levels, and to be expected, others did increase or necessarily were added to the list. Overall, I find the proposed budget acceptable, and I am grateful for the hard work it achieves. I'll specifically mention four items that the public has been noting. First, East City Park stage. Obviously, it can't be built for what it was many decades ago. Stage use these days exceeds the number of uses and technical complexity than before. The new build will address a number of issues and honor the total value of the former stage and has considered public input. The park has earned a showcase the stage represents and attracts income for the town. Two, climate mitigation. I encourage the city to continue exploring potentials for city and community solar projects and conservation, increase city ops electrification, and further fuel reduction savings. Three, affordable housing, a very complex national issue that cannot be solved at the city level. Rash or short-sighted decisions will exacerbate the problem. Runaway development can displace or devalue current residents' home investments and town character. So be creative, wise, and fair to avert any net loss on multiple levels. Making progress in phases toward fixing up and revitalizing the downtown streetscape is materially necessary, like safety, economically advantageous. And it can significantly contribute to our cultural experiences and regional identity.
we hear what goes on in East City Park, and we can't get away from it. But it is, and I could be here complaining about that, but I'm not, because the arts and culture in this city are important, and I want to express my support for keeping that in the budget. I think we've heard some concerns here about allocation and priorities, and I understand all of that, and I certainly am sympathetic to those concerns. But it is a way too easy a solution to say, oh, well, let's just cut the arts. Who really needs that anyway? It's just aesthetics. Well, the quality of our life in this town and the value of our property in this town and the economic benefit that this town gets from bringing people in for arts events and to participate in what Moscow has to offer are benefits that may be difficult to quantify, but they are no less important.
One of the people who gave neutral comments on the proposed budget was Kathy Dawes, who is a Democratic candidate for House Seat 6B in the state legislature, challenging incumbent Republican Brandon Mitchell of Moscow.
I truly do support the arts here and feel that we should be. And I also understand the concerns about safety, public safety. And I want to point out that with the police officer reductions, the forensic detective position being terminated, that the street funding has been down, is all due to the state decisions at the legislative level. The point I'm really trying to make is that this council is under a lot of restrictions that have been placed on them by our legislature. And I admire your ability to do the best you can to put together a budget that is minimally increasing our costs and trying to maintain the character of our city. And I thank you.
That was Kathy Dawes. Council members said they support the budget that they have worked on for months and also said they support building the East City Park stage. They passed the budget 5-1, with Councilmember Evan Holmes voting against because he wanted to remove the $137,000 for the Parks Master Plan from the budget for reconsideration. The council also held a public hearing on the city's fee increases and voted to increase a number of fees.
For new home heating installs, electrification is trending. In the first quarter of this year, heat pump sales beat fossil fuel furnaces by a record 32%, according to new data. Clean Energy Voices say heat pumps are more efficient and cost-effective because rather than creating hot or cold air like fossil fuel-based systems, they move existing heat, either out of a home to cool it or into a home to warm it. Kristen George Bagdanov is with the Building Decarbonization Coalition, which authored the report. She says the U.S. is at an electrification tipping point.
Energy bills going up, the oil shocks that we're experiencing have really been leading people to want technologies that are efficient and that don't seem to rely on this up and down fossil fuel global economy.
Oregon leaders are keeping up with buying trends by requiring heat pumps in all new housing rather than traditional ducted AC units. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, the technology saves the average household about $500 per year on energy bills, although critics argue high installation costs mean the mandates make new builds too expensive. While installation does bring a higher price tag, a major driver of the electrification trend is new housing. The report shows 3/4 of new apartments in the U.S. are heated by electricity. George Bagdanov says electric home building has reached its highest peak yet at 61% of the market share, while gas heating in new homes has fallen to its lowest point.
New homes are going to be using the energy infrastructure for many decades to come. So we want to make sure we are starting fresh with the most modern, efficient, and clean technologies possible.
George Bagdanov adds it's not just approaches to building that have shifted. She says as energy rates continue to balloon, people are becoming more aware of how policy, not just their daily habits, impact their wallets. She adds it's a hot button issue for politicians in the upcoming midterm elections who are shifting away from blaming consumers for high costs.
They're talking about investor profits for private utilities. They're talking about who should shoulder wildfire costs.
She feels high utility rates rates are a systemic problem that requires systemic solutions. This story was produced with original reporting from Matt Simon for Grist. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Wyoming ranchers have been selling off pairs of cows and calves after this winter's record low snowpack led to severe statewide drought, according to a new wildfire report, in part because they didn't know how they would feed them. When it became clear that water would be scarce, farmers in Carbon County were forced to grow hay instead of feed. Climate and energy reporter Dustin Bleiseffer says warmer than normal temperatures in spring sent snowpack downstream early, and it's been mostly dry ever since.
That kind of low snowpack situation in the winter really set the stage for low-flowing streams, reservoirs not filling.
Roughly 80% of the Cowboy State is experiencing severe drought, and nearly half of the state is experiencing extreme drought, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. The Wyoming State Engineer's Office is enforcing water restrictions, even for parcels that have enjoyed primary access based on first-in-time, first-in-right ownership dating back to the 1800s. Many small reservoirs have reached deadpool levels where water no longer flows downstream. Ranchers have had to drive herds to their favorite pastures weeks or even months before they normally would, and after grasses became scorched as early as July, Bleiseffer says they're also paying more for hay reserves.
They're starting to really run low on pasture grazing, and they're already starting to look at buying supplemental hay, not only to get through the winter, but maybe start putting their stock on hay even earlier.
Some ranchers have decided to move their remaining livestock to Nebraska in the fall to feed on corn stalks. Wyoming has experienced moderate to severe drought since 1999, and the only years that saw relief were in 2008, 2014, and 2015. One rancher outside Moorcroft told Bleiseffer that he's definitely seeing trends in weather conditions changing.
He was looking back through the family records dating back, 50, 80 years ago, and he's noticed that there's a change in the seasonal pattern. And that these patterns are just changing to where they're just not as reliable as they used to be.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly clear through Thursday, low 51 tonight, high 87 tomorrow, low 51 Wednesday night, and high 93 on Thursday. Partly cloudy Thursday night and Friday, low 55, high 93. Current temperature is 84 degrees. Real-time air monitoring shows the air quality at this hour in Moscow, in Lewiston and Lapway is good. The rest of north central Idaho, moderate. The air quality at this hour in Pullman is moderate, and the air quality in Clarkston and Spokane is also moderate. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.